everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sale, and today we're kicking off the new year with a look ahead to the Costa Book Awards. Stuart Turton mixes murder, mayhem and sci-fi in his dazzling debut, The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle.
An Agatha Christie-style murder mystery with all those lovely tropes that you'd ever want, the isolated manor house, the upper-class guests who all have shady secrets, and then a body at the end of the day, which is the aforementioned Evelyn Hardcastle.
Candy Gourlay takes the long view of colonialism and gender politics in her novel, Bone Talk.
My hero is a little boy who is growing up in this headhunting tribe, has never seen the outside world, and suddenly the Americans arrive and he realizes that the world is not what he thought it was.
And Professor Richard Wiseman examines why we like to scare ourselves with spine-chilling stories.
You get the adrenaline, which is rather fun, the thrill of that, but you know deep down that you're in a safe environment.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle is the dazzling debut novel by Stuart Turton that everybody's talking about. A spine-tingling blend of Cluedo, Quantum Leap and Groundhog Day, it's a book I just can't put down. So I'm hoping that he doesn't let anything slip during this interview. Stuart Turton, welcome to Read On.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
So I was given The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle because my friends know that I love a good classic crime thriller. And at heart, it is a classic 1920s country house murder, but it's got all sorts of other influences, sci-fi, quantum physics. For those who haven't had the joy of picking it up yet, can you give us a bit of a blurb, please?
I absolutely can. I've always got a blurb at the ready. So it's a, as you say, it's an Agatha Christie-style murder mystery with all those lovely tropes that you would ever want, the isolated manor house, the upper-class guests who all have shady secrets, and then a body at the end of the day, which is the aforementioned Evelyn Hardcastle. But the trick is that the day of her murder keeps repeating over and over and again in the Groundhog Day-style loop, and our detective, our protagonist, can't escape that loop until he solves her murder. Now, the big tricksy bit is that every time he wakes up in this loop, he's in the body of a different guest in the house. So he keeps bumping into future hims and past hims, and they mysteriously and very strangely don't actually all want the same thing, which keeps tripping him up.
Fantastic. I'm glad I got you to do that.
Well, that's been 2 years in the making. That's me at a lot of parties scratching my head trying to explain my book to people.
It keeps you turning the pages throughout. What were the influences on you? Were you a crime buff as a young man growing up?
I absolutely wasn't, no. I mean, I'd read Agatha Christie, so they were the first books. At 80 years of old, I had stacks of those, and I just read them and devoured them one after another, and I absolutely loved those and that specific style of mystery story, and that led me onto the other Golden Age crime writers, and I just tore through those. And then I went where everybody goes. I went from Sherlock Holmes and then Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. And then once I got through those, I kind of just drifted away from the entire genre. So I was kind of almost done with it by the time I was 11 years old, which is very strange. And I didn't come back to it really until I wrote this book when I was 33 or 34. So crime wasn't actually a huge influence on it, apart from Agatha Christie and those authors I've just mentioned. There was far more sort of, and that's going to sound incredibly literary and worthy, but it's far more sort of Franz Kafka's The Trial for that sense of unease, Aaron Matthew Roy for that sense of that playfulness with time and that ability to sort of like chop and change and have things appear in the wrong order. So I kind of drew a lot from those authors.
As you say, everything about Blackheath House and the surrounding area seems, well, I think one of your characters says, designed to unsettle the nerves. It's a very, very creepy place. And it's corrupt, isn't it? Everything is dripping with decay.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because the fundamental problem I had when I first set out to write this novel is that the problem facing my protagonist is somebody says to him, unless you can solve this murder, you can never escape this house. But, you know, on face value, he's in an upper-class house with upper-class moneyed people at this really rich gala party, and then there's a big ball at the end of it, a big costume ball, and it all should be very, very nice. He should be having quite a nice time. And my wife pointed that out early in the writing. She was like, well, why would he ever want to escape? Like, why would he ever want to get out of there? It sounds like he's having a great time. So I had to sort of drape everything in this corruption and this awfulness and make it so that it was as unappealing as possible. And, of course, that also ties into what we're doing with the period, which is we're looking at, you know, the inherited wealth and how that's poisoned the people at this house and what they've done with it. And they're basically all the worst archetypes that you could ever imagine, but we try to twist them around and do interesting things with them. But fundamentally, they're all just there to make this character, my protagonist's sort of journey, as hellish as possible.
And there's a real sense of fun and games within the book. I mean, it does read like a Cluedo novel, what with the potential murder weapons and the caricatured butler and footman and the overweight, gluttonous lord. I get a sense that it was very fun to write as well.
Oh, it was the most fun thing. But I knew going into this that it was going to take me a long time to write. I told my wife a year, and when I first set out, a year seemed like a very long time to me. It actually took 2.5 in the end. But I knew that I would have to, because I'm very restless by nature, and that would have to entertain myself every single day I was writing it. I would have to find something in it to keep me going. So that's why, hopefully, it's got that sense of fun, because I was just trying to entertain myself all the way through. And all those archetypes, the sense of games, the sense of play, that all came out of the Agatha Christie. It all came out, for me, every time I read an Agatha Christie, it felt like a board game. It felt like I was sitting down to play opposite Agatha. She would lay out the house for you in great detail. And some of those books had maps, like ours does. She would tell you who the characters were, and that would be your list of suspects as well. And then you would have all the weapons and the possibilities. So they always felt like board games, much to the chagrin of my sister, who probably wanted to actually play games with me, but I was, you know, off reading Agatha Christie and playing with her instead. So it all just kind of comes out of the source material, and then me honestly trying to entertain myself and not go completely insane in those 2.5 years.
Yeah, I'm wondering whether anybody's actually managed to guess the outcome early yet, because I feel thoroughly bamboozled. And normally I've got a fairly good sense where a crime novel's going, because I've read so many of them. But I knew you have this wonderful freedom of you'll give us a clue through the eyes of one character, and then you'll prove it to be a red herring 50 pages later when Aidan, your protagonist, turns up in another character's body.
Yeah, that was such fun to do as well. The other thing I have a lot of fun with is presenting the solution to you before you've even asked the question, because it is a time travel book. So I can put the solutions right in front of you very early, and then just because you don't know what they are, there's no context for them, you don't know what they mean, and you kind of forget about them and move along. But layering that was incredibly difficult, and making sure that there was always, so even as you got a solution, you would dig into your solution and find 3 more questions behind it. That was always the sense I wanted from this book, that questions only lead to ever more questions. But it went through a lot of edits to get it to that point where that was satisfying, because the first version of it, the very first draft, was effectively a David Lynch novel. It was just vignettes, like weird, hallucinatory vignettes that didn't really connect to each other. It was crazy making, but thankfully I had 3 early readers who read it for me and could help me start to tie it up, and then it obviously went through an agent, and it went through my publisher and editors, and we got it nicely tied up so the reader can follow on without having to stress out too much about holding on to every little detail and clue.
Yeah, I feel like I'm getting a very fun lesson in quantum physics, which, you know, as an English graduate, I wouldn't necessarily sit down for. Did you learn much about the potential of quantum physics and time loops and so on and so forth? Or was it all there already?
It was kind of already there. What actually happened is when I put my concept down on the page, I realised that I was going to have to go into these things because my character would wonder about it. And then you're left in a very precarious position, because how much of the novel do you want to make about those things? You have to reference them, and you kind of slightly have to explain them. But the more I talk about them, the more it becomes a science fiction novel, which I very much didn't want it to be. I wanted it to be an Agatha Christie murder mystery novel. So I had to define very clearly how much of that. And what I ended up doing was looking at 19th century philosophy. So looking at the sort of philosophy that would have been floating around in this period, and that these characters would have been aware of, and perhaps would have been, you know, the conversation. And that's kind of how I ended up defining it. I went to look at these theories that were floating around then, the predominant theories of quantum physics, of time travel, because they did have them. They were interested. They were immersed. And I kind of set my stall there. So there's no real later learning. There's nothing really coming from what we understand about it now in terms of string theory and all that sort of good stuff. It's very of a period. And that gives me a nice sort of like range of things to explore and talk about and put in the novel without feeling that I had to give you a Stephen Hawking lesson in science.
Well, it certainly works. And it's been phenomenally successful. Are you surprised how successful the book's been?
Every single day. Every single minute of every single day. I honestly thought I was writing this book for about 7 people, including myself and my mum, because I just had to. I just really wanted to write it. I loved the idea of it. When I first came up with the idea of it, I assumed that somebody else had already written it, and I was half remembering a book I'd read a long time ago. So I was blown away when I sort of Googled it, and it wasn't, you know, it hadn't been done. And then from that point onwards, I had to write it. So, yeah, I mean, it's been the fact that other people I've engaged with it, and the fact that it's like sparked other people's imagination has been amazing. I've had so many people who've done drawings of Blackheath and the characters, and they've sketched out things, and I had one person on Twitter who just live tweeted me his theories as he was reading the book. So just every time he thought something was happening, he would tweet me, and he was like, I don't want any answers, I'm just putting this here so you know what my thought process is as I go along. And just seeing somebody engage with the book in that way, never mind the amount of people who've done it, the very fact that people just jumped aboard this roller coaster and went with it is just wonderful.
I'm reminded of some of the stories about the Victorian suspense novels of Wilkie Collins and Lady Audley's Secret, you know, the interaction that you're getting from your audience. You have created a bit of a melodramatic sensation, haven't you?
Yeah, well, not what I intended to do, but like I think that's the power of social media. I mean, Social media gets a really bad rap for understandable purposes sometimes, but there's also this wonderful side to it where it allows readers to interact directly with authors. And something like this where there's a question every page, there's a possible solution every page, there's hopefully something that takes your breath away every page. Having people just come up to me through social media at the exact moment that something's happened that they've really enjoyed and tell me about it is brilliant. It's become a real part of my experience of the book. So I only ever intended to get on Twitter to kind of market the book and then disappear, but I think I'm going to stay on it for a bit longer now.
And now you're shortlisted for the Costa First Novel Award. Are you hopeful of success? We're talking just before the announcement.
I can't even imagine winning. I couldn't imagine being shortlisted for it, truth be told. When I turned up on that list, it just my head's still spinning from it. It's such an honour, and it's such a just brilliant sort of coda to the year, and a coda to the book, and all the hard work that everybody put into the book, my publisher, my agent, the publicists. I mean, everyone who has worked on this book has actually thrown themselves into it, and they give it so much effort and so much love. So it just feels like a really nice just thing for us to all experience at the end of the year. But as for winning it, I couldn't imagine it. I think I'd just have to lie down for a week or two.
And I understand the TV rights have now been auctioned as well.
Yeah, that's right. So they went before we published it, which was a bit of a strange experience. I put that down to the power of my agent. So yeah, they were sold, I think, when it was still in the proof stage. So somebody at a television company read the proof, which is the thing you send out to other authors and newspapers and stuff before the book is actually published, so they can get a feel for it and maybe blurb on it, put a quote on it if they want to. So somebody read it and they liked it enough to come to us and say, would you like some money in return for the rights? And that's what happened.
Who do you envisage playing Evelyn Hardcastle?
I've said this a million times, but it is absolutely true. I think if I thought the story would have worked better as a television or a movie, if I could see it that way, that's how I would have written it. I would have gone away and written a script and tried to sell a script to somebody. But for me, it honestly was always a book. It always felt like the complexity, the foreshadowing, all the things that go into making it an enjoyable read, it had to be a book for me. And that goes into the characters. So I envisage them as sort of literary characters. So in my head, they don't really have faces. They're just a bundle of traits and quirks and drives and impulses rather than actual faces and bodies. I mean, I put those in because writers have to, but the amount of times my character would have brown eyes and then blue eyes and then he'd be bald and then he'd be running his hand through a full head of hair, it kept happening. So I don't really have any images attached to any of these people, so I can't imagine who could possibly play them. I like Steve Buscemi in absolutely everything he does, so if you put Steve Buscemi in there, I'll be happy, but I don't know who he could possibly play.
I and many of the other Read On listeners have read the book as an audiobook, and Jot Davies is just terrific. I get the impression he was having the time of his life reading it as well. Did you have anything to do with him being selected as the narrator?
No, I didn't, but I'm so happy he was. I heard just nothing but positive stuff about his performance. Everybody, people have like come out to tell me that that was their favourite part of the book, that the way he did all the voices, the way he captured the spirit of all the characters. And actually, he was so diligent before he'd just got the job, and before he was about to record, he actually gave me a call, and he had a notepad full of questions for me on different dialects and where these characters could possibly be from in the UK, and you know how they would interact with each other, and sort of the words they would use and intonations and just period detail. And to be honest, most of it I'd never thought about. I felt so guilty. I was just sat there listening to these brilliant questions without any brilliant answers to give him. So he has done, I'd say he's done as much work in his performance as I did actually writing the book, because there was so much I couldn't tell him that he's filled in beautifully.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
Yeah, I do. So I generally have three books on the go. I'll have an audiobook from when I'm out sort of running or doing long walks or going to the train station. I usually have a book in the bedroom and have a book in the living room because, thanks to my daughter, as I said, I'm usually in one of those two places. So, yeah, I do love an audiobook. So I absolutely understand how, you know, the wrong narrator can destroy an audiobook. So I'm so glad I got Jot.
Absolutely. One thing that I did notice is that the book has a different title abroad. What's the reason for it being called The Seven and a Half Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle?
So it's actually only The Seven and a Half Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle in the US. Everywhere else, in every translation, it's going to be The Seven Deaths. And that's purely because, from my understanding, the US market works slightly different than the UK market. And the US market is sales are very much decided on title alone. So forget what the book is about. Kind of forget about what the jacket will be. The title is the only thing that matters. And a few months before my book came out, a book came out in the US called The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, which is just so unfortunate and so incredibly unlucky. But because of the way they list books, they were slightly worried that if that book went well, then it would eclipse ours. And if it went badly, then people may be a bit worried about taking a book with a similar title, even though they've got nothing to do with each other. That one's an historical romance, I believe. I've heard amazing things about it. And there has been a lot of confusion. So many people, again, have tweeted me or wrote me to tell me that they bought Evelyn Hugo instead of mine by mistake or vice versa. So I can just hope that they've enjoyed both of them by accident, if that's happened. But so we just had to change the title very slightly just to, I say, try and avoid some of that confusion. But it really hasn't worked.
Well, thank you for clearing up that mystery for me. I now have to go away and clear up the mystery of Evelyn Hardcastle myself. I've still got a good 300 pages to go. So it only remains for me to say, Stuart Turton, thank you ever so much for appearing on Read On and for writing one of the most entertaining books that I have read for years.
Oh, I appreciate that so much. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
And good luck with the Costa Prize.
Thank you. I'm off to lie down.
I forget everything between footsteps. Anna! I finish shouting, snapping my mouth shut in surprise. My mind has gone blank. I don't know who Anna is or why I'm calling her name. I don't even know how I got here. I'm standing in a forest, shielding my eyes from the spitting rain. My heart's thumping, I reek of sweat, and my legs are shaking. I must have been running, but I can't remember why.
Jot Davies narrating The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, written by my guest Stuart Turton. Thanks to HarperCollins, The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle is available from the RNIB Library as TB 703605. And since this interview was recorded, The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle has won the Costa First Novel Award, making Stewart one of the five authors now vying for the Costa Book Award 2018. And Stuart Turton will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Symptoms are divided into early, which include headache, loss of appetite, dizziness, fatigue on minimal exertion. I had three of these four in Ladakh.
Himalaya by Michael Palin.
And worsening, characterized by increased tiredness, severe headache, walking like drunk, and vomiting.
In his most challenging journey, Michael Palin tackles the Himalaya, the planet's greatest mountain range, a virtually unbroken wall of rock stretching 1,800 miles from the borders of Afghanistan to southwest China.
What to do? Asks the big metal signboard. The answer is unequivocal. Descend, descend, descend.
Talking Books every day at 2 with a repeat at 10. Or catch up with every aired episode at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, we're previewing some of the titles shortlisted for the Costa Book Awards. But before we discover what inspired Candy Gourlay's new novel, Bone Talk, have you ever wondered why so many of us love scary stories, such as The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle? Seeking an answer, Robert Kirkwood consulted a professional.
Available from RNIB Library now is 59 Seconds by Professor Richard Wiseman.
59 Seconds. Think a little, change a lot. Psychologist Professor Richard Wiseman exposes modern-day mind myths promoted by the self-help industry and presents a fresh approach to change that helps people achieve their aims and ambitions in minutes, not months.
A clip of 59 seconds available from the RNIB Talking Books Library by Professor Richard Wiseman. Now, Richard Wiseman, Professor of the Public Understanding of Psychology, said fear is a strange emotion. When it's genuine fear, we don't like it. But we do like to rehearse fear in a very safe environment, like watching scary movies or TV. So, Professor Wiseman, why do we enjoy what you're calling framed fear?
I think it's a very good question, and the research looked at exactly that question. And the answer is that when we are genuinely afraid, we have adrenaline pumping through the body as we get ready to run away or fight or whatever it is. But of course, that is in a negative situation. It is not an enjoyable emotion. What's interesting about roller coasters and scary radio shows and TV programs and so on is that you get the adrenaline, which is rather fun, the thrill of that, but you know deep down that you're in a safe environment. The zombies really aren't going to sort of jump out and actually start attacking you or whatever it is. So you have this kind of rehearsal of fear, but you have the upside of the adrenaline without the downside of actually being in a properly scary, threatening situation.
I suppose the same could be said for scary talking books as well.
Oh, absolutely. Anything. Where there is a sense of, you know, putting you in a different situation, a different context. We are humans incredibly good at imagining ourselves in a particular situation and telling stories to one another. It goes back, you know, many, many years to sitting around the fire telling stories and many of them being scary. That notion that we can absorb ourselves in a situation, believe that we're actually there, but yet deep down know that we're not, it I think is a fascinating psychological state.
What was interesting in the research was the British men who would send their partners down to see to investigate a noise in the night.
It was a phenomenal finding. So this was asking the question, you know, what would you do if you're laying in bed with your partner and you heard a sort of banging downstairs or something? And 1 in 10 men said that what they would do is send their partner, maybe their wife, down to investigate, which is quite a novel approach to fear. You would have thought that hopefully that they might have gone down to find out what was going on. So, yes, that really did kind of surprise us. And it made me laugh as well, actually.
And having a partner seems to be important for watching horror on TV.
Well, watching with others. And so A little bit like laughter. Screaming is a social signal. So if you hear something funny and you're on your own, you don't tend to laugh. You obviously find it funny, but you don't laugh. If you're with others, you're far more likely to laugh. It's about letting people know that you got the joke and spreading merriment and so on. Exactly the same with all these sorts of scary experiences. You're more likely to jump and scream and do all those sorts of things, grab the other person and so on, obviously, if you're with others. And that then builds the experience for them because it becomes contagious and they send it back to you and so on. So even the way we respond to these things is actually unconscious. And again, there's a fascinating psychology around it. You'd think you're just screaming because you see something scary. Actually, you're screaming to let other people know you've seen something scary.
Now, I've done some research on talking to blind people about roller coasters, and is there a fear on a roller coaster when you can't actually see how high up you are? And the findings we got was the perception of speed is the scary thing. But do you think these jump scares and the things on TV work as well when you can't see them?
I suspect that some work even better and others don't work so well. So if you take away the visual medium, then obviously you're focusing on the auditory side of things. And so when you're looking at what I think is actually the best type of fear, which is where you're slowly getting drawn into the story, it isn't just somebody suddenly jumping out on the screen, which for me is a kind of cheap thrill. It's sort of like, of course, that's going to make you jump. But I think what's really wonderful about a Victorian ghost story is the one that slowly pulls you in, takes you into that world, and suddenly it's all rather uncanny, and you're not certain exactly what's going on. And I think The Voice is very naked for that, you know, because it just sort of takes you in, and you have to use your imagination to immerse yourself in that rather than a film which does all the work for you. I think that's a wonderful art form, and it's one which I think should be celebrated.
In TV and radio dramas as well, you can't underestimate the importance of tense music as well, though.
Oh, absolutely. And also silence. I mean, if something is silent for a short period of time, that can be really quite tense for people because it is mimicking the genuine fear response, which is to go very quiet and go very still. But you can't have it for too long because it gets monotonous. So it's all about balance. I don't think we're ever going to come up with a formula for fear. You know, it's always going to be an art form. But yes, absolutely, the music that slowly draws you into it, absolutely crucial.
What about yourself? Are you a scare junkie?
For certain things, I'm not a roller coaster fan, but I do enjoy haunted houses. I love wandering through those, you know, those things that sort of have at fun fairs and so on. I love ghost trains. So it depends. I do enjoy some horror films, but they tend to be ones with a strong sense of narrative rather than the kind of jump scare ones, which don't really quite do it for me.
You yourself have a YouTube channel that came from your book Quirkology, and it seems to be very popular with children. Why is that?
I guess we have a lot of psychology on there, and so there's short videos which involve magic tricks or illusions or things that kids can do at home, and started about 10 years ago, actually. So YouTube has just been around for a couple of years when we started, and now we have about 2.5 million followers on it. And it's lovely. I get emails from kids all the time that say the reason why they're studying psychology is because they saw our Quirkology videos on YouTube. So it's a great way of getting psychology out there. Sometimes it makes you feel a little bit old when they're saying, oh, you know, I'm in my second year degree in psychology, and I've been watching your video since I was 10. But it's a wonderful way, I think, of spreading what is my passion, which is this just love of the human mind and trying to understand the beauty of our complexity, I think.
Now, where did that come from? Because a lot of them do involve not magic, but illusion.
Absolutely. So I used to work as a magician. So for many years, I was going around doing card tricks on stage, doing illusions. And you realise there's a huge amount of psychology within magic. You have to be a good psychologist to fool an audience. You have to know how they think and feel at any one particular moment. And that's how I got into psychology, because of that. So I have a rather odd career path. But I hope some of that passion will come across when people watch the videos and try the tricks out. And maybe, you know, some of those kids will then go, wow, this is interesting. And that will put them on a path to looking into the area a little bit more deeply.
And I've got a question from my son who says, what was the first magic trick you ever learned?
Oh, my goodness. The first one I ever learned, it was I used to go and visit my grandfather, and he would do a trick where I'd put my initials on a coin. It would disappear and appear in a box that was in his pocket. And I used to badger him, say, how on earth could you do this every single weekend? And he said eventually to me, he said, the answer is in the library. He said, there are books in the library on magic. It's in one of those books. So I went there, read everything, eventually found it, and that was the very first trick that I performed. And I still perform it, where the coin disappears, ends up in a box in your pocket. So it all goes back to me visiting my grandfather when I was about 8.
Now, we started off with a clip of your book, 59 Seconds, which is available in the RNIB library. Self-help, that actually does work. Before we end, could you tell us why smiling when you're unhappy would help?
that's what's called the facial feedback hypothesis, that you would think that in terms of emotion and facial expression, it's a one-way street, that when you feel happy, you smile. And that is obviously true. However, it turns out that faking it, it turns out that our expressions also affect our emotions. So if you fake it and you put a smile on your face, it instantly cheers you up. It's one of the quickest ways of doing it. And so if people try now, if listeners try it, just smile for around about 20 seconds, they will feel better. And that's what 59 Seconds is about. These very quick things that are evidence-based that make a difference to how people think and feel.
Professor Richard Wiseman, thanks so much for joining us today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
59 Seconds by Professor Richard Wiseman is available as an RNIB talking book now, and his other books are available commercially from Audible. For more information on the talking book service, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
Thanks to Robert and Professor Richard Wiseman. Do you have a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
RNIB Library has the largest library of its kind in Europe, with over 60,000 items in the collection. You choose the books, you choose the format, and we deliver to you. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to hear the books of Stuart Turton's life, let's hear from another author shortlisted for this year's Costa Book Awards. As a girl growing up in Manila, Candy Gourlay wondered why none of the books that she read ever resembled her tropical home. So it took her years to fulfil her dream of becoming an author. Her first two novels, Tall Story and Shine, were shortlisted for a host of awards, including the Silip Carnegie Medal. Her latest book, Bone Talk, is up for the 2018 Costa Children's Award, establishing beyond doubt that Filipino stories belong on the pages of books too. She came to our Camden studio to tell me more. Candy Gourlay, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So, for those who haven't yet read Bone Talk, can you set the scene?
Well, Bone Talk is set in a place called Bontoc. In fact, the title is how Americans mispronounced Bontoc when they came and invaded the Philippines in 1898. So that's the setting. In 1898, the United States invaded the Philippines. And when you got to the Philippines, Manila was like a Latin city with bullfighting and opera and all that kind of stuff. But just outside were a lot of tribes. And in the mountains were these headhunting tribes. The Bontoc lived in a region somewhere north of Manila, and they were headhunters. And my hero is a little boy who is growing up in this headhunting tribe, has never seen the outside world. And suddenly the Americans arrive, and he realizes that the world is not what he thought it was.
And for him, he has assumed as he's growing up that he has known the full extent of the world and he's going to become a warrior in the traditions of his tribe. And there's a line in the book that says he believes that everybody has black hair. So he's rather disconcerted when he sees his first American.
Well, imagine if you'd grown up in a place where everyone has black hair. I grew up in a place where everyone has black hair. And then you meet your first fair-skinned, fair-haired, blue-eyed person. I mean, it must be really quite worrying. And that's what I tried to capture. I mean, I remember, well, I was introduced to the outside world through the magic of TV as a child in the Philippines. But I had never thought that I would live abroad or be myself a foreigner in another place. So my life living here in England, it's 30 years now, has been a constant culture shock and cross-culture, you know, bumping cultures constantly.
And is that why you write historical fiction, that actually it's easier to examine those themes from a distance than close up?
Well, this is the first time I've written a historical novel. My first two novels were contemporary children's fiction, kind of heartwarming, with all of that stuff of culture clash. But this one, I found out about this story and I thought, can I write it? But it was really, really difficult to commit to writing this book because the history is not written by the Bontoc themselves. Most of the history is written by the Americans. And you can imagine, when I started researching it, a lot of the material was so racist and you could not hear the voices of the people who I wanted to write about. So I was very wary of committing to writing the book.
Samkhad's culture is very ritualistic. It's very religious, for want of another word. And next to that, the Americans look like savages, really, as they claim to be bringing civilization to their headhunters, is quite a clash of cultures.
It is. I mean, when you look back at that era, the constant refrain that you heard from the American propaganda, because they had to sell the idea of colonizing the Philippines to the American public. And the way they sold it was that, one, they wanted to Christianize Filipinos. Now, the Philippines was colonized by Spain for 300 years before the Americans came. So they were going to Christianize the Catholics. But these people in the mountains were not Christians because the Spanish never managed to get that far. I think they gave the Americans a good reason to continue with the colonization. They had this kind of publicity campaign where they took photographs of the headhunters, and one guy even made a toured America showing off these photographs and saying, this is why America has to be in the Philippines, to save these people, to show them what being civilized is all about.
And it's not only questions of imperialism, but also questions of masculinity that echo down through to our age that you raise in the book as well. Samkhad is a young man and wishes to become a warrior, expects to become a warrior, and yet his best friend, Luki, is just as strong, just as resilient, and because she's a girl, has no hope of becoming a warrior.
Exactly. Growing up in the Philippines when I was a little girl in the 1960s and 70s, there were very fixed ideas about what girls could do and boys could do. And I would look with envy at what my brother was allowed to get away with, whereas I had to behave, I had to act in a certain way, dress in a certain way. And then when I started to dream of doing things, I wanted to act on stage, but I wanted to play the heroes. I didn't want to play those screaming damsels in distress wearing terrible dresses. And I channeled all of that into Luki. I was telling somebody the other day that even if their culture was that old mountain culture from a long, long time ago, I'll bet there were little girls over there who said, why do I have to wear a skirt? Why can't I fight like my brothers are allowed to fight? And I wanted to capture that in the story.
Do you know, I think that's something that will resonate with a lot of blind listeners, that blind characters are only ever cast as stricken victims or sonically superpowered. And it's very frustrating. We're pigeonholed, I think, especially in film and literature.
Yes, I think that's a universal experience. Women pigeonholed this way as a writer of color, as a Filipino. When I'm invited to speak in festivals, it's always the diversity panel where I talk about never seeing myself in books. And I'm like, I want to talk about story structure. I want to talk about, you know, all the things that the other writers are allowed to talk about. But I think things are changing now, though. There's such a great awareness of diversity and how people all come from different backgrounds. And we are consciously trying to not make diversity the issue.
I agree. I think diversity is actually a very divisive issue. If we look at how we differ, we'll forget what we've got in common. One question I would like to ask. I know that you're a strong and respected voice in the Black, Asian, minority ethnic world as far as publishing is concerned. And I was wondering if there's anything you feel that we as disabled writers can learn from the progress that's been made in the BAME world over the past decade?
The thing is, it hasn't been over the past decade. The truth is, for 20 years, the publishing industry has been aware of the inequality and the lack of representation of Black ethnic minority voices in publishing. But it's a very slow-moving train, and it's really, really hard to change. Right now, because of a lot of activism in the United States, there are a lot of voices raised. We are talking about it. There are a lot of efforts that have started. But until you really see systemic change, because the problem is not that there is a lack of talent. The problem is there is a lack of access because the system is filled with people who are not aware that that talent exists outside. And also, people like me growing up and not seeing myself in books, never seeing a Filipino in books, so much so that when I was a kid, I thought Filipinos were not allowed to be in books. I didn't give myself permission to write stories. And I think that's probably the only advice I would have for disabled people who want to maybe write or participate in the arts. I think you can't wait for permission. Let us just make things and then hold it up and say, here, I made this. What do you think? Try to get it to as many people as possible. Don't wait for someone to pick you and say, hey, you can fill my diversity quota. Don't wait. Make things, get it out there, and hopefully, you know, we'll accelerate the speed with which the world wakes up to the need for diversity.
And I guess actually the dissemination of ideas and writing via the internet, being able to create a forum for your writing and find other people who will be your audience, must have helped empower that as well.
Well, the internet is a powerful tool for raising awareness. But at the end of the day, if you want to write a book, all you can do is sit down and do the time at the laptop. And it took me 9 years to get published. So I did my time. And now, you know, it's really nice being shortlisted for the Costa. I hope it's going to inspire a lot of people who think my story doesn't deserve to be between the pages of a book, because I think every story deserves to be heard.
So as that young girl growing up in Manila, what were the books that fed your imagination?
Oh, do you know, I was a massive reader. I spent all my time in the school library. But the funny thing about growing up in a place like the Philippines is there was no publishing in the Philippines when I was growing up. It's kind of very telling because now there's a lot of publishing going on. It's a vibrant publishing scene. But when I was a little girl, a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, there were very, very few books that were published in the Philippines, and especially not children's books. Those were the days when there would be a door-to-door salesman selling encyclopedias, Reader's Digest compilations, and collections of classic books. We bought all of those books. So I read from Collins Junior Classics, stuff like that. Lots of Enid Blyton. I loved Enid Blyton. I was desperate to know what scones tasted like and what was ginger beer and all of those things. It's kind of like food porn, isn't it, Enid Blyton? There's a lot of talking about tea and stuff. And when I drank my first cup of tea, I was so disappointed. And when I got here and had my first scone, it was like, oh, it's just a bun.
Quite a dry bun at that sometimes.
It's a very dry bun that needs a lot of butter.
Now, I hear that you did a pretty rigorous research effort on this book, that you took yourself off to the mountains. Is that true?
I did. It's not an easy place to get to. You fly to Manila and then there's an 11-hour journey and quite a difficult one to get into the mountains. And then it's quite basic, but it's the most stunning part of the world. It's one of my favorite places in the world. And because I'd written a little bit of the book already by the time I'd gone to the place. So the setting is these mountains that have been carved into rice terraces. So every mountain is carved into steps. And you walk along these very narrow ridges amongst the rice terraces. And I've seen lots of photographs of this place. It's stunning. Everyone takes photos and you see them in tourist brochures and things like that. But when you get there, then you hear the voices of the people working, singing, shouting in the rice paddies, the snorting of the water buffaloes. And then you look in the water and there are snails and fish. There's tiny fish in the rice paddies high up in the mountains. And crabs. I mean, that surprised me. The crabs really surprised me. So I had to have a bit in the book where someone was having a fight. And when they got up from the mud of the rice terraces, they find crabs in their hair.
And does much of Samkad and Luki's civilization remain there still?
The arrival of the Americans completely changed that society. If you go there, you will still see people. They still sing their songs. They dress in their costumes. But the Americans succeeded in Christianizing the people there. So all over the Philippines, you will find Catholics. But up in the mountains, you will find Episcopalians. And when I tried to ask them, because one of the difficulties of writing the story was writing from the perspective of somebody who believes what they believe. They were animists. So I had to speak from their point of view. And I didn't know what did an animist believe. How was I supposed to write this voice? And I went up to the mountains and interviewed several people asking them, what was it like? And they don't know. They don't remember. And I had to piece it all together, reading anthropological texts that dated even back to the Spanish era. But I hope I've captured it. I don't know if I have. I had to fill in the gaps. So there's a lot of fictional imagination in the way the world is constructed and the religion is constructed.
Was there a tree of bones where the title comes from?
Yes, well, there really is a tree. So every community will have a tree, and they call it the patayan. And at the end of every village, you will see it's a cluster of trees or a large tree. And that was where they performed a lot of rituals. I just took the extra step of making mine a tree of bones, because I noticed when I visited homes in the mountains that they continued to practice some of their rituals, which involved a lot of animal sacrifice. And they would keep the bones. So I would go into someone's house, and from the rafters you will see chicken bones and water buffalo bones. And I thought, oh, that's really cool. I'm going to hang the bones from a tree and call the tree of bones. And when the wind blows, they can hear the voices of their ancestors speaking to them.
I know at the moment the book is out in hardback with a paperback on the way. Are there plans for an audiobook version?
Oh, I'd love there to be an audiobook version. We're just beginning. You know, it only got published in August, so hopefully, fingers crossed.
In the meantime, I know that you very kindly offered to read a passage out so that the listeners can get an idea of the power of your writing.
I would love to. So this is a scene in which Samkad discovers that he's not allowed to become a man yet, and he blames his dad. I ran clumsily, catching my elbows on the corners of houses, stubbing my toes on stones and dislodging small boulders that rolled and bounced ahead of me on the downward path as if they were racing me to the mossy forest. As I dived into the trees, I could hear the distant murmur of the tree of bones. Perhaps the spirits were discussing what had happened. Perhaps they were agreeing that I did not deserve to become a man. Kind spirits, I called into the trees. It was just a mistake. A soft breeze brushed against my cheek, and the tree of bones chattered louder. Mother, help me, I cried. Tell them Father didn't mean it. The chatter continued. If you know Father did not mean it, why did you tell on him? Mother, I whispered, are you listening? The chattering stopped. Had Mother Spirit managed to persuade our other ancestors to spare me? There was a flicker of movement behind a large tree, a low noise, something between a throat clearing and a grunt. The sound hardened as if it came from a throat filled with sharp stones. A wild boar! Slowly, slowly, I turned round, trying to spot the beast hiding in the trees. Nothing stirred in the undergrowth, though the grunting continued. I could feel it watching me, waiting for its chance to attack and gouge me with its tusks. Tambul once told me all I had to do in case of a boar attack was to punch the boar hard between its tiny eyes, and it would turn around and run in the opposite direction. I stared at my fists. They looked like pebbles on the ends of sticks. The grunting became even louder, shriller. I frowned. It sounded like... Was that giggling?
"Little Lukey," I roared. There she was, on a branch right above my head, bouncing up and down with a massive grin on her face. She had taken off her skirt and put on a breechcloth like mine. If her hair had been cut above her brow instead of tucked behind her ears, she would have looked exactly like a boy. "You know, you ought to stop calling me little," she laughed. "I'm the same size as you now." I scowled. "The ancients are going to bury you under an ant's nest when they see what you're wearing." "They can't see me now, can they?" "Nobody can." Lukey blithely slid down the tree. "You try wearing a skirt, Samkad, and see if you like it." She folded her arms across her chest. "So, tell me what's going on." Everyone in the village could hear the yelling.
Candy Gourlay reading from her novel, Bone Talk. That was beautiful, Candy. Have you considered that maybe you could narrate the book yourself?
Oh, I'd love to be asked.
Well, I think all the listeners will be able to hear that it's both a very powerful and a very entertaining book. And I, for one, will be keeping my fingers crossed that an audiobook version will be made. In the meantime, I wish you the very best of luck with the Costa Book Award. And I very much hope to speak to you in the not too distant future.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Bone Talk by Candy Gourlay is out now in print and ebook, wherever you buy your books. Let's hope that an audio version will be on its way soon. Now it's back to Stuart Turton for the books of his life. So, Stuart, was there a book that you read as a child or a young man that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
There was, and unsurprisingly, I think probably for most of you, it was a Roald Dahl book, but it was actually Danny Champion of the World, which I think is one of his slightly lesser-known ones. It's about the son of a poacher who finds out that his father's gone back to poaching and he ends up involved in his schemes, and it's just completely wonderful. My neighbour bought it for me when I was, I can't even remember what age, but it's the first book I ever remember reading cover to cover in an evening and just starting all over again. It's wonderful.
My father, without the slightest doubt, was the most marvellous and exciting father any boy ever had. You might think, if you didn't know him well, that he was a stern and serious man. He wasn't. He was actually a wildly funny person. What made him appear so serious was the fact that he never smiled with his mouth. He did it all with his eyes. He had brilliant blue eyes, and when he thought of something funny, his eyes would flash, and if you look carefully, you could actually see a tiny little golden spark dancing in the middle of each eye. But the mouth never moved. I was glad my father was an eye smiler. It meant he never gave me a fake smile, because it's impossible to make your eyes twinkle if you aren't feeling twinkly yourself.
Roald Dahl's Danny, the Champion of the World is available from the RNIB Library in Braille, giant print and as TB14707, read by David Thorpe. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yeah, it's The God of Small Things by Arunati Roy. I hope I'm pronouncing her name right. I don't think I ever do. But that's one of those books where I can open any single page of that, it doesn't matter where, and just reread it and I'll find something I absolutely love in the language or the structure, or there'll be some piece of beauty that I haven't sort of caught before. I think, again, everybody's read that book, so I won't go into the plot of it, but I don't need to read that cover to cover. I can read 10 pages and be absolutely delighted.
May in Armenham is a hot, brooding month. The days are long and humid. The river shrinks and black crows gorge on bright mangoes in still, dust-green trees. Red bananas ripen, jackfruits burst. Dissolute bluebottles hum vacuously in the fruity air. Then they stun themselves against clear window panes and die, fatly baffled in the sun. The nights are clear, but suffused with sloth and sullen expectation. But by early June, the southwest monsoon breaks, and there are 3 months of wind and water, with short spells of sharp, glittering sunshine that thrilled children snatch to play with. The countryside turns an immodest green. Boundaries blur, as tapioca fences take root and bloom. Brick walls turn moss green, pepper vines snake up electric poles, wild creepers burst through laterite banks and spill across the flooded roads. Boats ply in the bazaars, and small fish appear in the puddles that fill the PWD potholes on the highways.
The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB12440, narrated by Carol Boyd. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, but again, it's another book that absolutely everybody knows about. It's Circe by Madeline Miller, which I think is probably the best book I read the last year. I think Proof. I just think top to bottom, it's a brilliant idea. It's wonderfully executed. And again, her writing is so fresh and so fun and just so engaging. I love that book completely.
That word, nymph, paced out the length and breadth of our futures. In our language, it means not just goddess, but bride. My mother was one of them, a naiad, guardian of fountains and streams. She caught my father's eye when he came to visit the halls of her own father, Oceanus. Helios and Oceanus were often at each other's tables in those days. They were cousins and equal in age, though they did not look it. My father glowed bright as just forged bronze, while Oceanus had been born with rheumy eyes and a white beard to his lap. Yet they were both titans and preferred each other's company to those new squeaking gods upon Olympus, who had not seen the making of the world.
Circe by Madeline Miller and narrated by Perdita Weeks is TB703840. Stuart Hutton, thank you so much for sharing the books of your life with the Read On listeners, and I'll look forward to speaking to you again in the future.
Thanks very much. I look forward to it.
Don't forget that you too can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, full of book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. Or you can find us on Twitter. I'm at redsail, that's REDSZELL. And Robert is at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.